welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm your host this week, Aaron Hudson. In this edition,
I just want to make sure that, you know, this doesn't go unheard and that people know that someone just got fired without cause from an AMS position, you know, just to save the station money.
So if it turns out that Canada knew about it ahead of time, didn't do anything very much to enforce, and didn't really follow up on this, then we have a very worrying situation.
Her calls for help to the guards and the nursing staff were ignored. The guards moved her from her shared cell into a segregation cell after she'd been in labor for about 4 hours.
But first, here are your headlines. Outside British Columbia's legislature in Victoria, BC, thousands of protesters gathered to oppose the Northern Gateway Pipeline project and send a clear message to their provincial government that BC residents do not want this project to go forward. The project would carry diluted bitumen from Alberta's oil sands through the province of BC to the coast where it could be exported overseas. The pipeline has generated widespread opposition on numerous fronts. First, the pipeline is planned to cross through several First Nations communities. Concerns have been brought up regarding the environmental impacts of setting up such a pipeline and the safety of pipelines in general, particularly as pipelines built by the company behind this particular project, Enbridge, have a history of not being well maintained, as demonstrated by a 3 million liter oil spill into the Kalamazoo River in New England, USA in 2010. Protesters reportedly unfurled a black banner the size of an oil tanker during the course of the October 22nd demonstration. Meanwhile, in Hamilton, Ontario, the reversal of another Enbridge pipeline, known as Line 9, is coming under fire. At the end of September, an event called Stop the Flows was held to build community awareness of the pipeline and mobilize people to resist the project. Then, last week, a gathering was staged at the City of Hamilton's City Council meeting where a report on Line 9 was being presented. Once the direction of its flow is reversed, Line 9 will carry diluted bitumen from Alberta starting in Sarnia, Ontario through Quebec. Phase 1 of the project will begin with the pipeline's reversal between Sarnia and Hamilton. And in Fredericton, New Brunswick, last week, two reports were published regarding drilling for shale gas and its impacts on the environment. One report called for responsible shale gas development, with one of every three mines being devoted to research and development. The other report called for strict safety regulations to be in place before any drilling occurs. As a result, a province-wide debate on the next course of action is underway. Opposition is notably present from residents, as nearly 1 month ago, in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, residents protested an exploratory shale gas mine that was to drill around Lake Ainslie, the province's largest freshwater lake. The protesters blocked the sole highway in and out of Cape Breton for a total of 20 minutes, as reported by the Halifax Media Co-op's Miles Howe. Petroworth Resources, the company looking to drill the mine, has said that it will not be doing fracking, a process which is widely criticized for its negative impacts on the environment. In Prince Edward Island, at a construction site west of Charlottetown, demonstrators were protesting the realignment of the Trans-Canada Highway. Demonstrators are claiming the realignment is unnecessary and harmful to the environment, which includes 200-year-old trees. Local politician Bush Dumville feels the realignment is a safety concern due to an accident his daughter nearly had on a stretch of the highway in question. The demonstration was reported to be ongoing as of last week, though Groundwire cannot confirm whether the demonstration is going on at this time. And last week in northern Quebec, a blockade by an Inuit community on Route 138 near Sept-Îles, Quebec, was dismantled by Quebec's provincial police force. The barricade was in place for nearly 3 days in protest of ongoing exploitation and extraction of natural resources on the community's territory and the government's ongoing plans for northern development. Protesters say they've been continually and systematically left out of talks regarding northern development. Further details are unclear, as Groundwire was unable to receive information directly about the situation from the community. Finally, here in Montreal, October 22nd was a day of 4 different demonstrations throughout the city. The National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation took place, with a vigil led by family and friends of individuals who have died in Montreal as a result of police intervention. Two other demonstrations were linked to the student movement, one which called for the withdrawal of all criminal charges linked to the student movement, and the other called for amnesty and the right to demonstrate, along with serving as a launch point for an international national movement called Via 22. Last but not least, demonstrators in Montreal gathered outside the annual conference of Quebec's Petrol and Gas Association to protest projects involving fossil fuel extraction in Quebec, Alberta, and the Maritimes. That's it for our headlines, and we'll be right back after this. Now it's time for our feature stories. First up, we have a report from Carly Forbes out of CFRU in Guelph, Ontario, on two recent Supreme Court rulings related to a person's non-disclosure of their HIV status. Now it's time for our feature stories. First up, we have a report from Carly Forbes out of CFRU in Guelph, Ontario, on two recent Supreme Court rulings related to a person's non-disclosure of their HIV status.
The Supreme Court of Canada released decisions in two cases surrounding the criminalization of non-disclosure of HIV status. These rulings set a precedent such that people living with HIV must disclose that they are positive, even if they are practicing safer sex with the use of a condom, unless their viral load is undetectable or extremely low. I spoke with Cecile Kvechkin, a policy analyst with the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, about these rulings.
The Supreme Court of Canada on October 5, 2012, released two decisions in the cases of Mabior and DC, two cases of HIV non-disclosure. It's important to note that it's not the first time the Supreme Court looks at the issue of HIV non-disclosure. It already decided a case in 1998, where the Supreme Court actually decided that people living with HIV could be prosecuted for aggravated assault if they don't disclose their status to their partner before having sex that represent a significant risk of HIV transmission. In the two cases that was just heard by the Supreme Court maintained that rule that people living with HIV have to disclose before having sex that represents a significant risk of HIV transmission. But what is kind of surprising is that actually the Supreme Court kind of move backward by really kind of strictly limiting the interpretation of what a significant risk means. Now it has to be understood as a realistic possibility of HIV transmission. And in practice, it means that people living with HIV who use a condom may be criminalized for not disclosing their status unless they can establish that they also have a low or an undetectable viral load.
This ruling is a huge blow to positive communities across Canada. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire.
Our next feature follows a story that was uncovered last week. Off the islands of Haida Gwaii in British Columbia, 100 tons of iron sulfate were dumped into the ocean as part of a geoengineering technique called ocean fertilization. The scheme involves putting iron or other nutrients into the ocean to create a plankton bloom that can theoretically absorb carbon dioxide and act as a quote-unquote quick fix for climate change. Satellite images of the dump off Haida Gwaii show a plankton bloom of 10,000 square kilometers. Jim Thomas, who works with the Etcetera Group tracking geoengineering technologies, was one of the first to discover the dump that had taken place off the coast of British Columbia.
This particular scheme actually is in violation of at least three international moratoria. The London Convention on Dumping, about 5 or 6 years ago, came up with a statement that there should be no large-scale ocean fertilization activities of this sort. And that is actually enforced through national legislation here in Canada through the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. As well as that moratorium, there's also another moratorium that was agreed at the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is 192 countries, again, on ocean fertilization to prevent exactly this sort of thing happening. And then 2 years ago, there was a further moratorium on all geoengineering schemes in the open air. So, in fact, you have here sort of a triple breach of international agreement.
So how did Jim Thomas and the Etcetera Group discover the experiment had taken place?
Well, the Convention on Biological Diversity, where two of those moratoriums happen, is meeting right now in Hyderabad in India. And geoengineering is one of the hot topics there, as some countries would like to see, beyond a moratorium, a complete ban on geoengineering. And at the edges of that meeting, rumors began to circulate that something had happened in Canada. And we investigated, being a Canadian organization, and was horrified to discover that, in fact, there had been an ocean fertilization experiment back in July, and no news of it had got out. There's a lot of surprise and anger in Hyderabad, and in fact, just yesterday, the organizations that work around the convention, all the nonprofits and civil society groups and indigenous people, presented an award to Canada. They call it the Dodo Award, for being the country that has most harmed biodiversity as a result of this event.
The dumping was carried out by a private company called the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation. The company spoke with locals of the indigenous villages in Haida Gwaii and told the residents there that the project was a salmon enhancement project, quote unquote. The Council of the Haida Nation has since released a statement, dated October 18th, stating that the Hereditary Chiefs Council and the Council of the Haida Nation are in no way involved in artificial fertilization through dumping of iron compounds in the ocean around Haida Gwaii, direct quote. According to Martin Lukash's report in The Guardian, the Haida Gwaii community invested more than $1 million of its own funds into the project under the pretenses the residents were given by the company.
In this case, a private company has gone ahead and breached the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. And the Canadian government is supposedly undertaking an investigation into that. And we hope that they're going to take very swift and very serious action against this company for doing that. And of course, we then still have to discuss how to clear up the ecological mess that's been created. What's more concerning, however, is that it seems that the Canadian government knew about this ahead of time, that they maybe warned them that they shouldn't go ahead and gave them fact sheets saying this isn't legal, and so in that sense are not entirely culpable. But then since the middle of July, haven't really appeared to take any action whatsoever against this. And the chief officer of this company has been on national radio saying that Canada knew about it for a long time, Canada was helping them, that seven federal agencies were involved, that there were people from Fisheries Canada on his boat, all of which are very damning allegations. So if it turns out that Canada knew about it ahead of time, didn't do anything very much to enforce, and didn't really follow up on this, then we have a very worrying situation.
Soif et vive, there's always is another way.
Our next feature is a shocking story that comes to us from Carly Forbes.
Last week, Julie Bellotta gave birth to a baby boy in breech position in the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center. Her cries for pain were ignored by the guards, and she was taunted and then sent to segregation. Ottawa mother and professor in criminology Dawn Moore spoke about the details of what happened while Julie gave birth.
So Julie Bellotta was, is still incarcerated in the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center, which is a fairly notorious remand center in Ottawa. She was 8 months pregnant and went into premature labor. Her calls for help to the guards and the nursing staff were ignored. The guards moved her from her shared cell into a segregation cell after she'd been in labor for about 4 hours. The remand staff basically didn't believe Julie until the baby's foot emerged. And then they recognized they were in a crisis situation because Julie's baby was arriving as a breech birth, which is a very high-risk situation.
New mother Dawn Moore rallied together with other new mothers in the Ottawa-Carleton area in protest of the horrendous treatment of Julie Bellotta.
You know, a bunch of us moms with newish or fairly new babies were really heartbroken when the news broke about what had happened to Julie. And we, you know, felt not only that, you know, what had happened to her while she was in labor was incredibly wrong, but also the fact that she was being kept apart from her baby, especially when the Elizabeth Fry Society had quickly offered an alternative to house Julie in their halfway house in Ottawa where she could stay with her baby. She could room in with her baby. And so we quickly formed a coalition called the Mother and Baby Coalition for Justice. And we gathered yesterday outside of Madeleine Mayer's office. And Madeleine Mayer is the Minister for Community Safety and Correction Services in Ontario.
I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. At the start of the month, Kingston Station CFRC's business manager, Ayanda Nagoma, was called in for a meeting with Queen's Alma Mater Society, which acts as the station's board of directors as the station is in progress of becoming independent. At the meeting, Nagoma was told his position as business manager for the station was to be terminated, effective immediately. The termination of Nagoma's position was completely unexpected for CFRC and Nagoma. CFRC Alternative Frequencies contributor Joanna Plukinska prepared the following report featuring interviews with CFRC's former business manager Nagoma and current spoken word coordinator, Lisa Alders.
So then I walk over to the AMS and met with these two people. You know, they're like pretty nice as ever. When I walked in, just said, you know, thanks for coming. Just wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. And off the bat, there wasn't like a sense of urgency or like, you know, this was going to be a big deal. So I sit down, and then right away, they basically said the AMS Board of Directors has officially restructured CFRC's management, and they've dissolved the position of business manager, so we do have to terminate you without cause. And then, you know, there is some paperwork to fill out, and then they told me about their position, the new position that the AMS Board of Directors has created called the Sponsorship and Outreach Manager, which basically takes all of the advertising and sponsorship related aspects of the business manager position and puts it into a volunteer position with 15 hours a week, whereas the business manager's position is 30 hours a week. And instead of it being a salaried position, it's paid on an honorarium basis with $3,000 a year as the honorarium compared to a much more substantial business manager salary. It's like a third or a quarter of what the business manager would make in a year. So, I mean, like, once I even got into the meeting room to start with, I'd already been terminated. It was just making it, I guess, official, but it was already a done deal. As far as I know, no one at the station was consulted about it. It wasn't even brought up at the CFRC advisory board meeting that this was even a possibility that the AMS board of directors were thinking of. It just seemingly came out of the blue, but obviously they've been working on it for a bit, and we just found out. The other, I guess, financial aspect of the new sponsorship and outreach manager position is that the sponsorship and outreach manager receives 40% of a 40% commission of all the advertising that they bring in. So automatically, you know, whatever efforts that person is making, the station's only seeing 60% of that, which is worrying. And I brought that to the attention immediately of the two people I was meeting with and said that the station's advertising rates as are competitive, and they are, you know, competitive in terms of like other campus stations and markets similar size to Kingston, and that with this new 40% commission, if the station were to try and build in that 40% to the existing advertising rates, it would no longer be competitive with those other stations in the sector that are in a similar market size, and that it may decrease existing advertising revenue that the station has, because by inflating the rates, it could cross the line where existing station advertisers and sponsors just can't afford it, even if they really want to support the station.
Is it even realistic to think that revenue for advertising can go up by $3,000 in a year out of your experience?
I personally don't think so, based on my experience. I mean, I've only been in this for 5 months and don't come from an advertising sales background. But from my personal experience in this position, I don't think it's possible to increase advertising revenues by $3,000 while keeping our advertising rates the same, but also having, you know, potentially a new person who has to establish relationships and connections and confidence from, you know, the local business community and the local community in general to secure advertising. So, I mean, with those two things working against whoever's in this sponsorship and outreach manager position, I don't think they can actually get $8,000 in advertising revenue and another $5,000 in sponsorships. I just want to make sure that, you know, this doesn't go unheard and that people know that someone just got fired without cause from an AMS position, you know, just to save the station money, which is important, but it also was a decision that was made without any consultation of CFRC stakeholders, which that in itself I don't think is right. Such a crucial decision has been made about the station without the station's input at all.
It's really hard to know what exactly is going to happen to the station without a business manager. I mean, the AMS has stated publicly that it's because of our deficit that this decision was made, but we honestly don't think that eliminating the role of the business manager is the way to deal with the deficit. So, I mean, I am personally very concerned, and I know a lot of people are, that this is actually going to increase our deficit. Ultimately, we have no one. The AMS has, there was no transition that was given. He was fired immediately, so we have no one to take up the contracts and various business exchanges that IANDA was in the middle of, so we're automatically losing that money. But also in terms of the business manager playing a huge role in our funding drive, which is actually a much larger source of revenue for the station than advertising, since, as you may know if you're listening to this, we aren't big on advertising at the station, and to change the manager or the business manager's position to one that exclusively focuses on advertising is ridiculous and shows that they really don't understand what CFRC is about. It's not merely an issue of ethics here, it is business. I do honestly believe that this decision to eliminate the business manager will have a hugely negative impact on the station's finances, and I do not see how this will at all be effective in dealing with our deficit.
There will be paradise.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CKUT in Montreal, thanks for tuning in. I'm Erin Hudson. Music this week was by Montreal-based artist Sika. The song was Color Your Walls from her album of the same name. And this week's headlines were written by Erin Hudson. Special thanks for this episode goes to Carly Forbes, Joanna Plukinska, and Lisa Alders. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download the show at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.